Like Andrew said, this is not the first time that I've been here. And as my wife reminded me a little while ago, this is not the first time I've been here on an Easter Sunday either. I don't know how many of you might remember that time that I was here on Easter Sunday, but I came and I was speaking about the book of Esther. And my sense of humor being what it is, I decided to make an Easter Esther pun that went over about as well as you might expect. And there was like nothing but crickets. And I'm thinking, I just made a religion joke that offended the entire group. This is terrible. And afterwards, about a dozen people said, hey, I thought that was hilarious. I just didn't want to be the only person laughing. And so I thought if all of you had laughed, it would have been fine. But you don't have to worry about that kind of edgy humor tonight, because my sense of humor has evolved since then. Well, on that note, we're already finding out that this was not a wonderfully designed series after all, was it? Inviting me, who came up with that idea? Well, we are asking this question today, hasn't science disproved God? And I thought about beginning by saying no and walking off the stage, but I presume you want a little bit more than that this evening on this topic. So I want to approach this from a couple of different angles here. I'm going to say something first that is, we're not going to spend a lot of time talking about because it's not that important of a point, but it needs to be mentioned. We'll talk about something from a more kind of big picture, philosophical, I guess, sort of perspective. And then we'll talk some about science as well. And I am not a scientist by any stretch. And so I acknowledge that at the outset. I'm going to be showing you a variety of quotes from people who are scientists, none of whom are believers, and let them kind of talk about some of these things and then try to draw all that together. And so that's kind of where we're headed with this question of hasn't science disproved God? Andrew, is up forward or is down forward? Nope, down. Okay. So the first thing that I'd say, and this is the point that I don't want to belabor, I want to get through this very quickly, but I think it's important to note that there is no scientific consensus to the effect that science has disproved God. There are plenty of scientists who do not believe that science has disproved God. Science itself arose out of theism. Science begins with the presumption that the universe has order and regularity because there was a creator and there was a designer, and it's not just chaos and happenstance. So as science begins, as the Enlightenment begins, as people turn to study more and more, there's this presumption that you can find order because there was a creator. Now, as we've moved down the path of science, there are more and more scientists who don't believe, and I'm not telling any surprises there. You're very well aware of that. But there has never been a time where all scientists were atheists, including at the height of the Enlightenment and the height of rationalism. I just looked this week, and Wikipedia's list of Christians in science and technology page took me 15 page downs to get to the bottom of that. I didn't count them. 15 was high enough of a number for me to count. But you get the idea. And that's just their list of Christians in science and technology. I know it's not exhaustive because Todd Chandler wasn't on the list, nor was anyone else on the FC science faculty, and loads of other scientists who are believers. And also, while we are Christians and focused on a Christian reading of the Bible and a Christian worldview, there are other worldviews that are not atheistic where you can find scientists there as well. And we would disagree with them theologically, sometimes pretty significantly, but there are Jewish scientists, and there are Muslim scientists, and there are polytheistic pagan scientists, and there are deistic scientists, all of whom would agree that there is a God. And so, again, we don't want to make too much of this point, because just accumulating a list of names doesn't prove anything. Even if 100% of the scientists in the world agreed that there was no God, that wouldn't prove it. If 100% of the scientists agreed that there was a God, that wouldn't prove it either. So just a list of names is not much more valuable than it is, except to make the point here, because I do think it's worth mentioning, that there's no universal consensus, which you would expect if science had conclusively disproved the existence of God. But science hasn't done this because it is impossible for science to do. The reason why you can find believing scientists is because it is impossible for science to disprove the existence of God. Well, why is that? Well, let me suggest to you two reasons why that is. First of all, it's impossible because the scientific method has limits to it. Scientists employ what they call methodological naturalism in its inquiries. What methodological naturalism is using natural means to study natural things by adding natural variables to see natural results. It's dealing with nature is what it is. And that's not a knock on science. I mean, what else are they going to do? They're not going to employ the supernatural to their experiments. They can only do what they can do. And the scientific method employs naturalism because that's what they have access to. God is, by definition, supernatural. He is outside the realm of nature. It is impossible to study something that exists outside of nature by natural means. To discuss God is to leave science and enter into philosophy, to leave physics and enter into metaphysics. So methodological naturalism is a very valuable tool, but it needs to be used in its context. It has a context. It has a proper use, like any tool. You've heard all of the illustrations of that, right? You have to use a tool in the right context. Chainsaw, incredibly useful tool if you're cutting down a tree. Not so much if you're cutting up a steak or performing surgery. You think about that with any tool. When it's used for what it's supposed to be used for, it is incredibly valuable. If you try to use it for something else, not so much. Trying to use scientific method, trying to use methodological naturalism to study something that exists outside of nature is not going to get you very far at all. And so that's just part of the reality of this discussion, is that science is limited in what it can and cannot study, what it can and cannot comment on, what it can and cannot prove. That's just the reality of science. But in addition to that, I would also point out the limitation of human ability. What can, forget science for a second, what can we prove or not prove? Aside from naturalistic inquiries into God's existence, let's think about proving God exists or proving God doesn't exist from a human perspective. How might you prove that God does not exist? I don't know. May God strike me dead if he exists. Oh, he hasn't struck me dead. He must not exist. No, that hasn't proven anything. I mean, okay, maybe that proves God doesn't exist. Maybe that proves that God's not easily baited. He's not immature. You don't know what that shows. Maybe it proves deism. Maybe it proves there's a God, but he doesn't care about you. I mean, there's all sorts of things that might prove, and in reality, therefore, doesn't prove anything. What if you were to try to investigate the universe to see if there's a God? You have the ability, somehow, theoretically, to travel the entire expanse of the universe, and you go looking for God. And everywhere you look, you can't find him. And over the course of your journey, you have looked at every corner of the universe, and you've not found him anywhere. Have you thereby proven that God doesn't exist? Well, no, you still haven't. Because one, he might not exist inside nature, he might exist outside nature. Because again, he is, by definition, supernatural. That is what I think pretty much the broad consensus of a definition of God is. But even if he's within nature, what if he's just one step ahead of you the whole way? What if you're looking on Neptune and he's on Saturn? What if you're looking in the Milky Way and he's on some other galaxy? The only way you could prove by that method that God doesn't exist, if he is in nature, is to be everywhere at the same time and see everything at the same time and know everything at the same time. And if you can do that, then you can prove God doesn't exist. Except you've just proven God does exist because you have the traits of God. So that doesn't work out so well for you either. So the point of this is all, again, just to stop and think about this from a perspective of how difficult it is to even get into this kind of discussion of proving the non-existence of something. The difficulty of proving a negative is more monumental than we typically think of. It's really easy to prove that something exists. Find one example of it. That's all that it takes. But to prove that something doesn't exist, when the universe is as large as it is, when this planet is as large as it is. And even if you can't find any examples of it, that doesn't mean that no examples exist. It just means you haven't found any. And so, except in the very narrowest of investigations, proving a negative is virtually impossible unless you're omniscient and know everything that there is to know. Now, it's outside of our topic for today, and so I don't want to get hung up on this at all, but I would also point out that proving that God does exist is just about as difficult, because God exists outside of nature. That's not to say there are no evidences for it, don't get me wrong. I believe there are plenty of evidences. There's a lot of good reason to believe. But conclusively proving it, scientifically proving it, I'm not entirely sure how that can be done. I mean, the same limitations of science on disproving God apply to proving him as well. And on top of that, God wants people who have faith, which means he has kept some things a mystery. He has not told us everything that there is to know. He's not shown us everything that there is to know. And part of that may well be because seeing doesn't solve faith problems anyway. You've fallen into that trap before, right? I know I have, where I think if I could just see this, then I could believe better. Yeah, right. Just like the Israelites. They believed so incredibly well. Walked through the dry land where the Red Sea used to be. Drank water that came out of a rock. Saw the pyrotechnics at Mount Sinai. What incredible people of faith they were. Not a chance. They all died in the wilderness because of their lack of faith. Seeing is not believing. And God wants something other than just having everything proven and spoon-fed to us. And so there's a difficulty that exists on both sides of this issue of trying to scientifically prove this sort of thing one way or the other. Well, the last thing that I'd say along these lines before we start talking about some specific scientific fields and topics is, and I hesitate on this, and I'll qualify this in a moment. Scientists should stick to their field. And I know that there are caveats to that. But scientists are scientists. And the existence of God is a philosophical discussion. And what usually happens when scientists get involved in philosophy is they make all sorts of philosophical blunders. Because they don't know what they're talking about when they move into a different field. Let me give you two examples of how this might work. There's a fellow you might have heard of before. His name is Richard Dawkins. Richard Dawkins is a highly educated, well-credentialed, brilliant biologist who wrote a book called The God Delusion that argues against the existence of God. Now, there's another person. You may or may not have heard of him. We'll call him Nathan Ward. He is also highly educated and well-credentialed in the fields of apologetics and theology. How do you think Dawkins might react if I wrote a book called The Science Delusion, where I set about proving that everything that scientists believe is wrong? I don't know. I've not had this conversation with him, but my guess is that Dawkins would say that I have no business writing such a book, that I'm way out of my field and way out of my league. And he would be absolutely right. To which I say, pot, meat, kettle. When scientists step outside of their field of expertise to write about something that at best they dabble in the topic, don't presume that their credentials follow them. Just because Dawkins is a brilliant biologist doesn't mean he knows a thing about philosophical thinking. And the amount of philosophical blunders in books like his makes that point very clear. Now, the reason that I hesitate on this point is because we don't want to get involved in credentialism, where we think that if someone doesn't have a high enough degree in something, that they're just a complete idiot and can't say anything intelligent about it at all. That's not the case. Someone like Dawkins can think deeply about topics that are outside of his expertise and say very valuable things about them. In this case, he doesn't, though. In this case, he presumes that because he's a brilliant man who knows his field and has read a few choice verses out of the Bible that offend him, he knows what he's talking about. And he'll make absurd arguments about God must not exist because he's mean is really what it all boils down to. How can you believe in a God like the one that does all these terrible things? He has no concept of theology. That's why he makes the arguments that he makes about that kind of thing. The thought of the justice of an almighty God is a foreign thought to him. And so he says foolish things because he's out of his league. And so we just need to remember that scientists are scientists, that they're not philosophers. And while some of them may well say valuable things outside of their field of expertise, just because a brilliant man says something doesn't mean that it's right. Just because a well-credentialed person says something doesn't mean that it's right. And so, you know, search the scriptures diligently to follow the pattern of the Bereans. Think long and hard about these kinds of things. And so this is kind of my first approach to this topic, is to talk about it from a kind of a few bullet point sorts of things along these lines. What I'm going to do with the rest of the time that we have is talk about, I should probably know the number, it's like five or six different questions that come up in scientific inquiry. And depending on how the time goes, I'll have more or less to say about these as we go through. I've tried to build some padding into this. I'm going to share with you several quotes about these things as we move through them. None of these people are Christians, certainly not as we would understand Christianity. One of them, I think, was raised a Catholic and has been taken to some Protestant groups, but he has openly expressed doubt in God's existence and that religion is things that was made up to, you know, salve the ignorance of the masses or something along. So I would even put that person outside of this. And they're all scientists in various sorts of fields. And so let's talk about these. So let's start with this first question. It's an easy one. Where did the universe come from? Everything that exists, where did it come from? How did it begin? It's a pretty important sort of issue, maybe, just to think about. Well, for a very long time, scientists agreed that the universe was eternal, that it had always been around. There was never a time that the universe didn't exist, and everyone was okay with that, for the most part. It's all right. The universe has been around forever. That's how everyone thought about things. Well, then along comes the Hubble telescope, and they're looking more into astronomy, and they find out that the universe is expanding at massive, incredible velocities that we can't even begin to fathom. And they begin to realize, well, if it's expanding, that means if you wind the clock backwards and go back in time, it gets smaller and smaller and smaller until it all gets to a single central point. And it must have exploded into existence out of that. And that's what has come to be called Big Bang cosmology. The idea that there was an explosion that brought everything into existence. And all of a sudden, we have gone from the universe has always existed forever to the universe began at a certain point. Wow. Scientists have realized that there's a beginning. This is one of my favorite quotes along these lines from an astronomer named Robert Jastrow, who is an agnostic. He says, "Now we would like to pursue that inquiry farther back in time, but the barrier to further progress seems insurmountable. It's not a matter of another year, another decade of work, another measurement, another theory. At this moment, it seems as though science will never be able to raise the curtain on the mystery of creation. For the scientist who has lived by his faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He has scaled the mountains of ignorance. He's about to conquer the highest peak. As he pulls himself over the final rock, he is greeted by a band of theologians who've been sitting there for centuries." It's amazing. We learned the universe has a beginning. Yeah, you don't say. That's what we've been saying for thousands of years. And what's so remarkable about this is that in one of the common arguments for the existence of God, called the cosmological argument, you might have heard of it, there are two basic premises and a conclusion that comes from it. First, everything that begins to exist has a cause. Now, notice that carefully. I did not say everything that exists has a cause. Everyone's perfectly okay with the idea of something that is eternal in concept. But everything that begins to exist has a cause. Second, the universe has a beginning. Conclusion, the universe has a cause. I mean, logically, it's an ironclad argument. If the premises are true, the conclusion is true. There's no way around it. And so what this argument faced for centuries is attack on the second premise, which is the universe began to exist. And no one even bothered talking about the first one because it was so self-evident. Everything that begins to exist has a cause. Who doubts that? Who thinks that things just pop into existence out of nothingness all day long? You know, the congregation that I'm part of, 58th Street, we meet at the highly unorthodox and borderline heretical time of 2 o'clock in the afternoon for our Sunday service. And so I came here straight from there. We left our house at about 1:30 and I've not been back since. And this entire time, I have just been fretting and wringing my hands over the concept that a dog was going to pop into existence in our living room and defecate on the carpet and ruin everything. Just been losing my mind that this is going to happen. Right? You look at me and say, are you crazy? That doesn't happen. I remember a time a few years ago where one of my two sons, I don't remember which one now, was about 2 years old, and he was, you know, walking, kind of toddling around and doing something with his back turned to me. And because I'm a good father, I had a beach ball in my hand and I pelted him with it. And so he turned around and said, "Who did that?" And do you think that he would buy it if I said, "Oh, that beach ball just popped into existence in the middle of the air and drilled you in the back?" Even a two-year-old would understand how stupid that is. He would say, "No, you did it." And I would say, "Yeah, well, I guess that's right. Well, maybe if we talk about quantum physics." No, we understand this. And so for hundreds of years, everyone had to argue about, did the universe exist forever? This is the key piece of this argument. It's what theistic philosophers had to theorize. This is the nail in the coffin proof of God's existence in the cosmological arguments. And suddenly, science dropped it into our laps. You know what scientists argue about now? Well, maybe everything that begins to exist doesn't have to have a cause. Really? Because that happens all the time. Something that is so counterintuitive, something that's simple enough that even a two-year-old can understand, it doesn't happen. How did everything begin? That's a really important question. And fundamentally, the argument now as it shifted to, does everything that begins to exist have to have a cause, it's fundamentally an objection to God. It's not an objection to the logic of the argument. And I know that. Because for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, everyone was fine with the idea that the universe had existed forever. There is no objection in anybody's mind to an eternal what? An eternal thing. An eternal universe. So if there's not an objection to an eternal what? Why is there a problem with an eternal who? What is so fundamentally different about a universe and a being that one can be eternal and the other cannot be eternal? And I have not found a good answer to that question anywhere that I've looked. Why this is so much more objectionable than that is. Well, moving on, our next question is from the origin of everything to the origin of life. We've narrowed it some, but unfortunately it hasn't gotten any easier at all. I don't know how much Todd's going to talk about the question of the difficulty of spontaneous generation of life. But it is a monumentally difficult thing to do. I won't get into details, but just to form a single functioning protein molecule, which you need several more of in order to have a single-celled life form, by it just randomly happening somehow all on its own, apart from any sort of guidance to the process, it's been compared to a variety of things in terms of the statistical difficulty. Some have compared it to taking a box of Scrabble tiles and dumping them out and it just happening to land on a fully formed sentence. How many times do you think you have to drop that box of Scrabble tiles in order for that to happen? Fred Hoyle, who is another atheist, says it'd be like a tornado whirling through a junkyard and assembling a fully functional Boeing 747. Now, to be fair, this is more rhetorically potent than it is scientifically precise. and a variety of scientists have taken issue with what Hoyle has had to say. But even in its exaggeration, I think it makes the point very well that this is a monumentally difficult thing to do. And there have been a variety of suggestions that have been posed by different scientists that we're not going to talk through, you're welcome, this afternoon. But none of them are satisfactory in terms of answering the questions. Let me give you two more quotes that are, I think, more meaningful than this one. The first one is by a scientist named Stanley Miller. He was part of an experiment back in the 1950s that was designed to prove that life could spontaneously begin on an Earth that had a certain kind of atmosphere to it. If you've heard of the Miller-Urey experiment, that's the experiment. This is the same Miller of that experiment. He said, the problem of the origin of life... if I could type. The problem of the origin of life has turned out to be much more difficult than I and most other people envisioned. Francis Crick is another one who talks about this. Francis Crick was one of the co-discoverers of DNA. Very famous scientist for that discovery. Also, very much an atheist. He's probably bordering toward anti-theism. He's someone who said, jokingly but revealingly, that Christianity is okay for consenting adults to practice privately, but it shouldn't be taught to children. That's where he stands on this sort of thing. Crick says, every time I write a paper on the origin of life, I swear I will never write another one because there is too much speculation running after too few facts. This is one of the most honest quotes I'm going to show you today because it's laying it all out there. How did life begin, according to one of the people who found DNA? I don't know. That's his answer. And every time I think I'm onto something, I wind up walking away thinking I'm never doing that again because it's a bunch of speculation chasing after very little factual information. So where did life come from? It had to have come from somewhere. How about biological information? DNA. DNA is a storehouse of information. A single strand of DNA, it's been said, contains more information in it than the entire Encyclopedia Britannica put together. It's what has the information that gives every cell everything that it needs to function properly. Bill Gates, a computer scientist, said DNA is like a software program, only much more complex than anything that we've devised. That tells you a lot about DNA, doesn't it? It's like a computer program, but something more complex than anything that we've ever come up with. Well, I mean, obviously nature just happened to bring this about on its own, right? I mean, you know about that wind and erosion division they have down at Microsoft that produces computer technology. They just take nothing and they throw it in a room with a bunch of natural forces and computers pop out one after the other. Of course not. How do you get computer programs? Designers, that's how you get it. Intelligence. Programmers give you computer programs. That's where this comes from. This is a very illuminating quote because of what it tells you. Where does information come from? And you stop and you think about it. Every known case of information that you have ever encountered in your life, whether consciously or subconsciously, you've presumed there was intelligence behind it. I guarantee you that that is the case. Imagine you're driving down the road one day, and on the side of the hill as you drive into this small town, it says, "Welcome to Springfield in the bushes." And you think, wow, that's really amazing. Those bushes have just somehow grown into such a shape that it produces a sentence. What a coincidence. It's the name of the town we're driving into. I wonder if those bushes are why this town's called Springfield, because they randomly grew in that shape. Never would think that, right? Been to Mount Rushmore? Man, funny how those faces have just grown in the side of the mountain rock. Must be erosion. That's what produced the faces of those four presidents. Erosion. I'm sure that's what did it. Never would think that in your life. You're in a cave somewhere touring, and the tour guide stops and shows you a native painting on the side of the wall. And it tells the story of the hunt. and they capture the animal and they kill it, and there's the great celebration and the feast. And you say, wow, it's amazing the stains of the dripping of water over the years and how it's produced this beautiful picture. No, every time you've ever encountered information in your entire life as simple as a drawing, as complex as a sculpture, and certainly all the way up to computer programs, every time you've ever encountered information, you have presumed there's intelligence behind it. Not once have you ever seen information and thought anything other than intelligence was behind it. So within DNA, we have the single most complex bit of information that we are aware of. Just happened. All on its own somehow. There's a book that was written by Carl Sagan, I believe, called Contact. Turned into a movie. And in this book, it's about contact with extraterrestrial life. And they determine that there must be life out there. And they must be trying to contact us. Because there is a series of prime numbers that start coming in to the listening stations. A series of prime numbers, that's it. The universal language of mathematics. You can hear it and you say there must be intelligence behind it, because there's no other way that just a series of prime numbers in sequence, that's not going to happen on its own. So if a series of prime numbers can't happen on its own, how on earth is DNA going to happen on its own? Where does information come from? How about the appearance of design? This really made waves in the scientific community in the late 90s and into the early 2000s when a biochemist named Michael Behe wrote a book called Darwin's Black Box, where he talked about something he called irreducible complexity. And he's talking about design within nature, and we won't get into all of that today. But basically the idea is that when you look at life, not just in the big picture, but at the molecular level, you find example after example after example of things that look designed. I would say because they are designed. Things that look like a motor on an engine. Things that if you take away one little part of it, it no longer works. Every part is necessary for it to function. And that's a pretty big hit against Darwinian evolution, because, you know, Darwin says everything must continue to function in order to evolve to the next level. Everything looks like it's designed. Notice what Richard Dawkins says. He says, biology is a study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. We may say that a living body or organ is well designed if it has attributes that an intelligent and knowledgeable engineer might have built into it in order to achieve some sensible purpose. Any engineer can recognize an object that has been designed, even poorly designed, for a purpose, and he can usually work out what that purpose is just by looking at the structure of the object. That's a pretty telling quote too, isn't it? You can look at something that's designed, even if it's badly designed, and say, that was designed. And it was designed for a purpose, and this is what that purpose was. So when you look at a bacterial flagellum, for example, and the multiplicity of parts, and the fact that it not only looks like a motor, it has parts that have the same names as motor parts that scientists have given to those parts because they function the same way a motor does, it looks designed. It's designed for a purpose. So where did this appearance of design come from? Again, is the question that we have to be asking all the way down. How about what Francis Crick says here along these lines? Again, back to Crick. This is the co-discoverer of DNA, if you've forgotten his name already. Crick says, biologists must constantly keep in mind that what they see was not designed, but rather evolved. The quote I showed you a minute ago, I said it was one of the most honest quotes. This may be one of the most dishonest quotes from a certain sort of perspective. Keep telling yourself that it wasn't designed. No matter what you see, no matter what it looks like, even when bad design can be recognized as design, according to Dawkins, keep telling yourself that it wasn't designed. Why do you think it is they have to keep telling themselves that? Because common sense says the opposite. That's why. You have to keep reminding yourself this wasn't designed. Well, why is that? Well, I'll share with you a quote at the end that tells you exactly why that is, but we'll come to that at a later point. So let's move on and talk about the fine-tuning of physical law. And again, we're not going to get into this in any kind of great detail for the sake of time, but this is something you could look up if you're interested in. It's called the anthropic principle or the anthropic principle, depending on who's pronouncing it. It comes from the Greek word anthropos for man. So it's this principle of physics that basically says the universe, the laws of physics, have been fine-tuned in order to support life. And there are loads of examples of this. The speed of light, the boiling point of water, the freezing point. I mean, just lists of examples where you take this long list of things, whatever they are in physics, and if you change those laws by as little as a percent or two sometimes, we all die. Like, you change the amount of oxygen in the atmosphere by the slightest amount, and either we can't breathe, or there's so much oxygen that everything's on fire constantly. And that's just one example. There are dozens of examples of this. So much so that Stephen Hawking said, the remarkable fact is that the value of these numbers seem to have been very finely adjusted to make possible the development of life. Who do you think's up there turning the dials on physical laws if they were finely adjusted to this end? Fred Hoyle says a common sense interpretation of the facts suggests that a super intellect has monkeyed with physics as well as with chemistry and biology, and that there are no blind forces worth speaking about in nature. The numbers one calculates from the facts seem to me so overwhelming as to put this conclusion almost beyond question. This is an atheist speaking. Hoyle said that this issue shook his atheism more than anything else he ever encountered. The universe is wired in its physical laws to support life. How did that happen? Where did that come from? That's a really, really big kind of question. Let's talk about one more question. That is human consciousness, a self-awareness that we have, where we can introspect, where we can think abstractly about things. Humans are far greater than biological life in general, of course. I mean, what can a tree think, right? But we're even in a different category from the highest form of animal life that there is. Our consciousness, our ability to think, our ability to introspect, our ability to abstract is unique on this planet. How did consciousness arise? Colin McGinn, who's an atheistic philosopher, says, how can mere matter originate consciousness? How did evolution convert the water of biological tissue into the wine of consciousness? Consciousness seems like a radical novelty in the universe, not prefigured by the after effects of the Big Bang. So how did it contrive to spring into being from what preceded it? Where does consciousness come from? How does that evolve by naturalistic mechanisms? Jeff Madel, also an atheistic philosopher, says the emergence of consciousness then is a mystery, and one to which naturalism fails to provide an answer. Where does consciousness come from? They don't know. And what's even more shocking is if you start studying the issue of consciousness, that there are many, including some, at least some, atheists, who believe that there is such a thing as immaterial consciousness, that your consciousness is not just a product of your brain activity, but there is a consciousness that is separate from your brain activity. It's what we would call your soul, is what we would call it. The part of you that lives beyond your death. You want to talk about something that science cannot hope to explain by naturalistic means. Where does immaterial consciousness come from? Well, let's take all this that we've talked about, put it on a chart. This is what exists. Everything that exists, exists. That's a bit circular, but you know what I mean. Life exists. Information within life exists. The appearance of design, we'll go with appearance rather than calling it design. The appearance of design exists. An ordered universe run by finely tuned laws exists. And human consciousness exists. Let me suggest to you there are two different, at least two different, approaches to where all of this came from. Because that's what we need, right? If we're trying to have a worldview about something, these are the kinds of questions that our worldview needs to be able to answer. Where did we come from? Where are we going? What is the purpose of life? These are the things that worldviews are all about. So what is the solution to this? Well, let me show you two theories. One of these theories is hard science. It is rooted in intelligence. It is rooted in reality. It is rooted in scholarship. The other view is blind faith. It's virtually a fairy tale of absurdity and anti-intellectualism, pseudoscience at the best. Explanation A says that nothing produced everything, that non-life produced life, that non-intelligence produced information, that coincidence brought about the appearance of design, that disorder produced an ordered universe, and that non-consciousness begat consciousness. That's one possibility. The other view is that something produced everything. Life produced life. Intelligence produced information. A designer produced design. An architect built an ordered universe. And consciousness begat consciousness. One of these is science. One of these is a fairy tale. Which one's which? Well, I'll tell you this. If we were talking about anything other than the existence of God, nobody would disagree. One of these is patently absurd, and one makes sense. I'm going to share with you a lengthy quote here, and I'm not going to comment much on it because I believe that Todd's planning on using it as well in his lesson, and so I'll give it to you to think about as something of a way of wrapping up what I've been talking about and a way of kind of passing the baton on forward. This is by a Harvard zoologist who is also not a believer. Bear with me, like I said, it's a bit long. Richard Lewontin says, "Our willingness to accept scientific claims that are against common sense is the key to an understanding of the real struggle between science and the supernatural. We take the side of science in spite of the patent absurdity of some of its constructs, in spite of its failure to fulfill many of its extravagant promises of health and life, in spite of the tolerance of the scientific community for unsubstantiated just-so stories, because we have a prior commitment, a commitment to materialism." That's the same thing as naturalism. They're not money-grubbing materialism that we think about sometimes. A commitment to materialism. It's not that the methods and institutions of science somehow compel us to accept a material explanation of the phenomenal world, but on the contrary, that we are forced by our a priori adherence to material causes to create an apparatus of investigation and a set of concepts that produce material explanations, no matter how counterintuitive, no matter how mystifying to the uninitiated. Moreover, that materialism is absolute, for we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. That's honest. I disagree with this man, but I respect his honesty. This is what he tells you, if I may paraphrase. Science's explanations are stupid sometimes. But we can't accept the alternative. We just can't. We have decided at the outset, a priori, we have decided at the outset that there is not a God, there cannot be a God, therefore we reject God. That's a perfectly wonderful use of the scientific method, my friends, to determine at the outset what the conclusion can and cannot be. Has science disproved God? No. Not even close. Science raises all kinds of interesting questions. Science, in a variety of ways, points us toward God. And when the scientists are honest enough to tell you, they'll tell you they reject God because they feel like they have to. And so as I think about this question, I keep coming back to that chart. It's what I've come to call common sense apologetics. You look at what there is and you ask how it's explained. And the explanation of the atheist makes no sense at all to me. It makes me think there must be a God. Because how else can there be everything? How else can there be life? How else can there be information all the way down? Well, thank you so much for your time and your attention this afternoon. Let's pray together. Our good Father, we're so thankful to you that you have created us, that you have created us for relationship, that we can know one another, that we can have companions and friends to help us through this world, but even more that you created us for relationship with you, that you've made us in such a way that we can come to know you, that in the world that you've shown us, we can grow in our knowledge and our understanding of this world as it points us toward you in the next world. Help us to be honest with ourselves. Help us to be honest with the evidence that we see. Help us in our lives to grow in our faith, to be able to answer the questions of the skeptic, and to bring more people to see you and your glory and what you have revealed. And it's in your Son's name that we pray these things.